Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast for December 8th. Trent Kling alongside Leighton Kling. Today, we'll have an interview focused on a study concerning customers and customer attitudes towards brand reputations with folks from Reputation.com. We'll talk about AutoZone reporting earnings. And as we fold Food Focus into Retail Focus, we'll talk in the second half of the show about Dave and Buster's. Big Lots leading off our show, they report happy earnings as well. Before we get into Big Lots, a reminder to please rate us on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or however, wherever you catch us every week. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and you could win an I Love Retail coffee mug. Simply leave your Twitter handle in the review before December 31st. We'll reach out at the end of the month if you are the lucky winner, and that mug will be on its way to you. Speaking of Twitter, you can follow us at Retail Podcast for all the business news we aren't able to fit on the podcast, as well as access to all of our episode links. So Big Lots reported last Friday, and like our friends Dave and Buster's we'll talk about later on, they beat on earnings per share figures. Then on Monday, it was announced that their CEO will actually have to take an emergency medical leave effective immediately. So it was a very interesting early portion of this week for Big Lots, coming up on the end of earnings season for many retailers. So for Big Lots, this was also for their fiscal third quarter 2017. Adjusted net income of $2.5 million and adjusted earnings per share came in at 6 cents, which is a slight beat of analyst guidance of 5 cents and also beat company guidance that was slated to be between 1 and 5 cents per share. Analysts thought it would be on the high end of that guidance and Big Lots actually beat that. Earnings per share around the 4 cent mark from last year's third quarter. This was their eighth straight quarter of earnings per share beats. Going back a couple of years ago, Leighton, when we started the Retail Focus podcast, and by the way, this is our 99th episode, we were talking about Big Lots closing down their Canadian division, reallocating some of their resources. It seemed to be a very uncertain future, but now Big Lots has kind of gotten traction here in the later portion of 2017, and things looking very good, even though they slightly missed analyst guidance in top-line revenue.
When David Campisi, their current CEO, came aboard, he was interviewed several times, and he said that really his sole mission, his priority number one, was to turn the company around, and that's exactly what he's done. And he even mentioned how they needed to restructure their executive team, and that is also something he's done. And if you go throughout this earnings call transcript, as we did, you'll notice that throughout the call, and this is something we'll talk about, he mentions his team more than a dozen times for perfect execution during the third quarter. And I think the transitionary period is pretty much taken place now. He's now several months into this transition, and we've seen a lot of closings of underperforming stores. And you can see now with their current store base, the store base that's really been looked at as the more profitable amount of stores that they have in their portfolio, you can see that revenue is now gaining, same store sales are being consistent. And these are numbers that a lot of retailers are seeing in a positive light given the current landscape, a lot of high bullish retail sales during the holiday season. Revenue for Big Lots came in at $1.11 billion. This missed analyst guidance, but by a very slight $5 million. And you see revenue still gained year over year by about 0.5%. This modest gain was a result of those positive same-store sales for which the company reported a 1% gain. Same-store sales is always an interesting topic for us to cover in regards to Big Lots because even before David Campisi took the role of CEO, this is something that on their investor relations page is talked about quite often. Same-store sales is something the company is very bullish on. They want to see positive comps year over year, quarter over quarter. And this is something they prominently display, like I said, alongside their annual reports and investor days pages. You see, same-store sales for this quarter marked the 13th out of the last 15 quarters that were positive, something that this company is very fond of. Given their transparency in this arena and relative joy about same-store sales, it is a bit odd considering some of the players, however, in the brick-and-mortar space and landscape have performed much better for much longer. We mentioned TJ Maxx recently with their earnings call, Costco, and even Ollie's Bargain Outlet, which is, of course, a steep discount retailer. All of these retailers can be compared to Big Lots. However, anytime you see positive figures, that's a very good thing for a company such as Big Lots. Again, honing down and really focusing on what they do best has proven out positive results for them. As some may have figured, since same-store sales were greater year over year than revenue, that can only mean one thing: less stores. The company has closed several stores over the past year, still now operating 1,430 in 47 states. And as we go through the call details from their earnings transcript, we see that they began the call by discussing how tough their third quarters have been in the past, particularly because of seasonal transitions, and trying to identify the winners in terms of product mix, what products are going to sell through, what products are going to be able to sell at full price and not get clearance at the end of the season. They seem to have found a perfect formula here, and this is something they had talked about in the second quarter, saying that third quarter is going to be strong only and only if the right strategies are put in place and they execute well, and it looks as though they did that. In terms of assortment, they had more for the fall and Halloween products. They saw some products from the summer related to the fall actually selling through, not at a discount, so that's very good in terms of both inventory and margins. And they have encouraging signs from the early Christmas merchandising push. They seem to be pushing out that merchandise in terms of displays and some of the first products onto the sales floor a little bit earlier this year. That should boost some sales for this fourth quarter. This quarter, aside from the seasonal strength that I just mentioned, they noted positive comp categories. And you look at mattresses, which is something they've been bullish on here in the more recent past. They said this category actually performed best in relation to others. Furniture was up low single digits, always a strong comp for them. Positive basket was driven, actually, they feel, by Big Lots credit card and a new leasing program, allowing customers to make these larger purchases like furniture and mattresses with little money down, around $49. And this is actually akin to Kmart's layaway program, although customers can still take the products home and enjoy them for the holiday season. Home was up mid-single digits, and that encompasses bath, flooring, textiles, and picture frames. Consumables was strong, but this is an area that I love to talk about with Big Lots because I'm a Big Lots customer, but I don't go there for furniture or mattresses or home products. I go there for consumables, which is a bit odd because when you think of food, you think Walmart, you think Costco, you think Target, you think Whole Foods. Not for me. I try to take advantage as a rewards member for the steep discounts they give. And this happens every month or so. I go in, get a 20% discount on several of my favorite food items. And again, their selection is pretty good, carrying all natural and organic items more and more. As of September, they also have more beverages too, is what they noted on the earnings call. Food, they said, is experiencing a bit of softness, and they said because of competition. They didn't say whether it was because of price or because of product mix with competitors, but overall, they said they are trying to adjust that product mix for the future. And this is something that I was a little bit disappointed with because as it pertains to beverages, yes, they need more beverages. That would be good. Everybody likes more sports drinks, and those carry better margins overall than food, which they do have a lot of competition with. However, I don't see that slight consolidation with things like breakfast foods is going to be the better thing because this is what I go there for. And to be honest with you, pricing wise, they are extremely competitive. So I don't exactly know what the problems are or what the opportunities are for Big Lots in this particular category. But for the Big Lots that I've gone to recently in Colorado, California, Kansas City, they've all condensed down some of these popular areas, and I wonder what they're bringing in to replace it. It's a little bit interesting, but I am curious to see where they transition to for the fourth quarter and beyond. As far as online sales, Trent, this is something that Big Lots is relatively new to. Overall, it seems like they're headed in a positive direction.
They mentioned it's up 1% in this last quarter. However, very few specifics in regard to online sales during this earnings call, other than the fact that they're still carrying an operating loss from the division. And this is something we've heard from several brick and mortar retailers as they try to make the conversion into the e-commerce and online sales realm. The bulk of their Big Lots rewards emails, though, still centered around online sales and offerings, whereas many of the incentives used to be around coming to and arriving to the physical stores. To put their digital business into context, the word e-commerce was only used twice in the formal call, despite all of their marketing information outlining e-commerce, and the word online was not used at all until the analyst Q&A portion of the former call. Overall, you get the vibe from David Campisi that they were very diligent in execution in quarter three, but they still maybe need to make some inroads in online sales to keep from taking a consistent loss in that division. He remarked that quarter four is pretty much a go, and it is just about logistics doing their part over the next month. Big Lots, of course, has a very unique system. Unlike Ollie's Bargain Outlet, which pretty much consistently buys nothing but overrun, overstock, or damaged freight merchandise and resells it, Big Lots is a little bit of both. It's like if Dollar General met an Ollie's and maybe folded in a furniture store into the back as well. So Big Lots has kind of an uphill battle because they don't have just the one operating structure. They're not like a Dollar General where they sell those consumables on a pretty regular basis, those HBA products on a very regular basis, and they have the constant churn and turnover there. They're not exactly like an Ollie's in that they have some products that are closer to full price. And then, of course, they have the furniture in there as well, which is definitely different from the Dollar General. So I'll be anxious to see how Big Lots performs through the fourth quarter, especially with their improved seasonal mix that they showed in the fall and in this latest third quarter. I think that's a positive sign, certainly, when you talk about Christmas decorations, Christmas trees, but also the Christmas shopping that people are doing there as well. Now, speaking of their CEO, David Campisi is out temporarily, in fact, after a surprising press release from the company on Monday. And what's striking about this to us is we were on the earnings call. He was giving a lot of credit to his surrounding team, not only entire areas, not only floor level employees, but also leadership positions as well. And oftentimes you look at CEOs that offer positive reinforcement to their staff as a good sign because it means the company is doing well, but also it means that that environment is there, the culture is there. And we counted at least 14 times he praised either whole functional areas of the company or individual leadership positions. Looking back a little bit, when Campisi took over as CEO, he viewed the company as something that needed a turnaround, and we discussed it, 24 months ago, that's exactly where they were at. And he said that it starts with the team. He mentioned culture quite a bit. He mentioned changing the culture quite a bit at the time. And we feel like he's done that, which is why this message was somewhat perplexing, especially after such a positive earnings call. He was hospitalized, in fact, according to the official company press release, soon after the earnings call concluded. And according to the company, he's now recovering at home. And it's not clear what exactly has happened, and certainly we want to respect his privacy there, but he's done a pretty good job in terms of turning Big Lots around, making sure their same-store sales are consistent quarter after quarter, and improving parts of the business he felt like needed improved. So now his executive responsibilities fall to Lisa M. Bachman, who's the Executive Vice President, Chief Merchandising and Operating Officer, as well as Timothy A. Johnson. He's the EVP there, also Chief Administrative Officer and Chief Financial Officer. So those two, Lisa and Timothy, kind of taking over these duties. And Lisa, in fact, on the call was someone he mentioned throughout as executing transitions well for the third quarter. The board, of course, will also be available for guidance. In a statement, the board chair, James Chambers, said, "We have complete confidence," and I quote this, "in Lisa and TJ and the rest of the leadership team at Big Lots to continue the company's strategic initiatives. David Campisi is an inspirational leader, and we look forward to his return to good health and to leading the company again," end quote. And certainly we wish Campisi a quick recovery. He was in the best of spirits, honestly, during the earnings call, answered very earnestly during the analyst Q&A, and didn't appear to be stressed too much about the company. We certainly hope that the impacts will be mitigated on the fourth quarter, and certainly that he's able to come back and lead the team into 2018. Now, shares of Big Lots were down about 3% on Friday, and it's tough to tell how much of that's because of the earnings call and how much of that is because of Campisi's hospital visit, but this week they've recovered a bit. Shares are trading around $58, whereas before Friday they were near $60, which represents for them an all-time high. They're up 21% over the last 3 months. The company as a whole up 100% in the last 5 years. And again, talking about when we started the podcast, Big Lots was floating just south of $30, obviously doing very well for themselves in the last 2 years. They have a $2.46 billion market cap with still a fairly modest price-to-earnings ratio of around 14.8.
We transition to more positive news, but this time with auto parts retailer AutoZone as they continue their climb back into robust same-store sales as they continue to build out their U.S. store count. As a refresher, many of our listeners are no doubt familiar with AutoZone, one of the three main auto parts retailers in the United States, alongside O'Reilly's and Advanced and CarQuest. We see that it's not just retail stores, however, they own certain website properties as well. AutoAnything.com, they also have IMCParts.net, as well as AutoZonePro.com for their commercial customers. They are very clear that they do not make money from repair, installation, or services in regards to automobiles. There are a number of macroeconomic factors when it comes to the auto parts retail industry, such as the age of cars on the road, something we've talked about in the past, weather fluctuations with winter and things like that, and summer weather as well, since many put off repairs until they can comfortably get outside to do them. That makes sense, and because of this, they tend to be a little less susceptible to larger economic downturns or upturns, and all three major auto parts retailers have a beta less than 1.0. A beta of anything over 1.0 would indicate that a company's stock is a bit more volatile than the market. So for instance, if a company has a beta of 1.2, it means that the company's stock is about 20% more volatile than the market as a whole. As a whole, AutoZone operates 5,480 stores across the United States. This is up by 157 stores at the same time a year prior, and expansion is a major part of what we'll be talking about in this story. Over the last 2 years, AutoZone has been a lot more even than their two competitors, with same-store sales figures ranging from negative 0.8% to positive 3.6% back in the second quarter of 2016. O'Reilly has seen massive swings, mostly upward in this time, and expanded their store count by 7% last year. Advanced Auto Parts, to put this in perspective, has seen same-store sales figures largely negative, including a decline by 3.4% in their third quarter ended October of this year. As we delve into earnings, we can see that these numbers are for their first quarter of fiscal 2018, as their quarters are offset by the norm by just a little bit, something that is actually a little bit annoying to Trent and I, as we always try to cover these earnings stories. It's always interesting to see the companies that do not adhere to the norm in terms of the fiscal years versus the calendar years. But for AutoZone, they see the largest sales in the third and fourth quarters, which typically represent their summer months. So this is interesting. Again, a different dynamic from AutoZone. As has been the case over the last 2 years, AutoZone's same-store sales were modestly up, an increase of 2.3% over last year's first quarter. However, this is important because sequentially, they've been struggling a little bit. They actually saw declining sales from November of 2016 to early May of 2017, negative 0.8% overall, but began a slight turnaround with fourth quarter same-store sales up 1% as announced in September. The 2.3% mark that they just reported was on top of 1.6% growth in 2017, or fiscal 2017, and their first quarter there, and was their largest single quarter same-store sales bump since the second quarter of 2016. Net sales, or top-line revenue, also up 4.9%, an increase to $2.6 billion overall. This is reflective, of course, of same-store sales, but also their overall store count. We mentioned over 100 more stores in their portfolio. They grew their total store count, not square footage, but the number of locations by 2.9% over the last 12 months. On the bottom line, Trent, it seems as though net income is also getting raised, and this is due to a number of operational factors, but it seems as though AutoZone is just performing a lot better than some of their counterparts.
Indeed, and on the bottom line, net income saw a 1% even boost to $281 million, net margins, therefore, of 10.8%. To put this in perspective, Advance's net margins sat just north of 7% in their latest quarter, and O'Reilly's net margins were 12.1% in theirs, so AutoZone nestled right in between those two operators. Despite the fairly small net income increase, diluted earnings per share increased 6.8% to an even $10 per share, and this is reflective of their massive share buyback program as they bought $353 million worth of stock in the first quarter alone. This is around 3.5% of their present day market cap. Now let's turn our attention to their earnings call. Now, most of the earnings call carried positive vibes for all the reasons we just outlined when going over the actual numbers. When we talk about the retail stores for AutoZone, their wholesale and commercial programs have been robust drivers for the company. They increased their number of commercial partners by 4.5% over last year's first quarter and sales by 6.7%. Of their $2.6 billion in net revenue, $491 million, or close to 19%, comes from their commercial sales category. So they're not just a public-facing retail store business in this case. They get about 19% of their overall revenue from their commercial partners. And they see white space here, too, in terms of share at least, as they currently demand just around 3% of the overall U.S. market share in commercial part sales. And that is, again, according to the company AutoZone. The lone negative during the earnings call might be inventory, as inventory on a store-by-store basis increased by 2%. This hasn't affected them yet in terms of numerically, as they're still showing robust earnings per share numbers, but it soon might, especially since the company reported an increased amount of inventory shrink in the first quarter. For an auto parts retailer, you not only have shrink from theft, which is more common than you might think, but also from products and parts expiring, just like a general merchandise retailer or grocer might. This is suggested, in fact, by their inventory turns. Inventory turns, a number we don't often discuss, in part because many companies either don't track it or don't make it public. Their inventory turns at AutoZone in the first quarter of this year were 1.3 times versus 1.4 times last year. That means they're churning over inventory less often and could eventually cause a buildup of inventory were this to continue. They mentioned an increasing amount of vendors choosing to implement minimum advertised price policies elsewhere on the earnings call as well. That's for AutoZone's e-commerce sites. We discussed MAPs, or minimum advertised price policies, on a previous podcast with an interview guest. You'll notice companies adhering to MAP guidelines when you have to add an item to your cart to see the final price, but they mentioned in the analyst Q&A that that's not really severely impacting operations at all. It just means that they have to program their website in a different way for those vendors or providers. One of the most interesting things came on the call, though, via the analyst Q&A. Their Mega Hub strategy came up quite a bit, and this strategy has larger stores in the AutoZone network that are actually responsible for delivering product to their smaller stores. The idea here is to increase inventory availability to the customer on a rapid turnaround. Auto parts, now more than any other industry, feature a diversity of products that cannot be carried in each store. Let's say you have a 1991 Mazda MPV and you need a part for that. Well, that's not a very common car anymore. So it's important to be able to fulfill the customer's need while also not burdening each individual store with inventory, and that's what the Mega Hubs are. Those are stores that carry a larger slice of their overall system inventory, thereby making it easier and quicker for the smaller area stores to source parts on behalf of a customer. This is actually similar to a system used by JCPenney, where they have classes of stores based on inventory amounts, although the service from JCPenney is not as regular and not as quick. So the idea here is that the Mega Hubs can dispatch parts from their store to other stores that are smaller in that Mega Hub's particular network, and some stores are even doing this multiple times a day or at least once a day. Not all of them, as we'll get to here in a second. Now, having this Mega Hub system where they've opened Mega Hubs, it's said to drive between 1% to 2% growth in the local stores surrounding the Mega Hubs. That's not an insignificant measure. About 4,000 of AutoZone's domestic stores, or around 74%, have Mega Hub service already. Now, volume growth of these individual stores in terms of sales depends on whether stores are receiving shipments once a day, multiple times a day, or on an overnight basis from these Mega Hubs. So the stores that are only getting overnight deliveries from the Mega Hubs, meaning that a part that they order from the Mega Hub gets there the next day, they're not seeing as big of a sales bump as the ones that are getting shipments multiple times per day. The more times per day they get a shipment in, the more you see that volume increase for the smaller stores in the Mega Hubs network. That makes sense. So the company is looking to decrease service response times by moving more stores to same day or multiple times per day service to the Mega Hub. However, there is a barrier to entry. There's a reason they haven't done this already. As it was called on the earnings call, it was a gating factor. And that barrier to entry is simply proximity, mileage between stores, and also they mentioned traffic load, particularly in California, are mitigating factors, and the company hopes to minimize those by creating more mega hubs in their store system. Right now, there are 18 mega hubs in their system. They want to go to 25 by the end of this fiscal year, so in about 9 months. Long-term mega hub goals are around up to 40 of these particular locations. And perhaps our favorite thing about the call in general is that AutoZone was very clear that they are still in the analytics phase regarding the build out of these mega hubs. They said that they're still learning the economics of these stores, and they didn't pretend to have all of the answers. They said, look, we're still learning as we build out this format. That's why they didn't want to promise any more than 40 of those locations. And originally they had targeted about 25 to 40. They're going to reach the 25 part by the end of this year. So it is possible that you might see more than 40 at some point in time once they get a hold on the economics of the situation. They also feel like it's a way they can enhance their competitive position in what's become a robust and crowded auto parts retail sector, with all of the big three adding locations almost on a weekly basis.
Well, we do have to talk about stock performance since they are publicly traded, and this is something that we like talking about a little bit more on the Retail Focus. And we see that immediately after the call, AutoZone stock popped from around $703 a share to over $733 a share. However, a slightly down market and an adjustment on what likely was an overreaction took it down to under $700 per share by midweek. And right now you can see that shares are around $704 as of recording this podcast on Thursday, currently around a $19.2 billion market cap with a price-to-earnings ratio of 15.85. If you look back to the overall stock price over the last 5 years or so, such an interesting company, sort of a bell curve here, and you can see that in 2014, the stock had actually hit the lows that they hit of this year. So you see that they've actually made back in the last couple of months all of the ground they've lost here recently. Over the last 3 months, you could have gotten in as low as $540 a share or so. And then right now, like we said, over $700 a share as of this Thursday. And so you see a company with a lot of opportunity, like Trent said, with mega hubs going forward, but also still unit growth. They're expanding the amount of stores they have in the United States. And one may question the long-term sustainability of such a business like AutoZone. But for the foreseeable future, people are still going to be driving their own cars primarily and not using shared services that Uber and other car services are looking to provide. And so I think there is going to be a need for individuals to go to these types of stores. And overall, cars, whether they're shared or not, are part of a larger network under a company umbrella, they'll still need to be maintained. So this is a business that's going to be around forever. And in my opinion, I don't think public transit is taking automobiles away from the roads anytime soon. So this is a company that still has long-term potential. And if you go back and sort of look at the highs of the stock in terms of the AutoZone stock price, just 2 years ago in July of 2016, you saw highs over $815 a share. So in terms of even the most recent past, they still have a long way to go in terms of share price and overall market cap space.
Well, our interview segment looks a little bit different this week, in part because we're bringing someone in to talk about a story we were going to discuss on the show anyway. As a new comprehensive report came out by Reputation.com talking about retail brands, in-store experience, and how certain brands could improve going forward. Now, we'll have an interview with two members of Reputation.com, Mark Lang and Brad Knoll. Mark is the chief marketing officer and Brad Knoll is the chief scientist to discuss this study. But first, it's important to talk a little bit about Reputation.com and the actual study. I'll begin with a quick history of the company. In 2006, Michael Furtick created Reputation.com. They have a global presence with offices in Europe and Asia. They've patented some of their applicable technology, in fact, some of it that they've used in this study, and they're seeking to apply their methodology and experience to areas beyond brick and mortar retail, including healthcare. Layton, for those of us concerned with retail, this study emphasizes how big the sales still are for brick and mortar, making up a reported 91% of total retail sales.
If you were to read and pay attention to all the media headlines out there, you would think that e-commerce retail sales actually made up the larger piece of the pie, over 50% or some crazy number like that. But you can see brick and mortar is still an essential thing for consumers. It's an essential thing for businesses that are in the retail sector. And you see, by looking at customers' reaction to certain programs and practices, they're able to actually extrapolate and really have a dialogue with the physical outlets to see how they can improve shopping experiences for that very customer. Reputation.com has looked at common responses from multiple retailers in order to identify certain themes and therefore postulate in-store opportunities that they feel could actually increase top line and bottom line numbers going forward. The firm has utilized machine learning techniques to dig through over 400,000 consumer surveys that were accessible via Facebook and Google. Over 8,000 locations were looked at with 28 well-known retailers spanning multiple sectors. And with that, Trent, we have a ton of data to go through. But for our purposes, we just want to look at the highlights for our listeners and really see what stores did the best in terms of in-store experiences and what stores have some opportunities going forward. But this is interesting because we mentioned the 28 well-known retailers. These are some retailers that are very well-known throughout the United States, and a lot are probably going to be happy about these results, and a lot are probably going to be disappointed. But there's no better way than to look at these results with an open mind and really see that customers are wanting more of an experiential time in these retailers, something to really differentiate from e-commerce. So this study includes Disney, Carter's, the Lego store. Children's stores actually made up the majority of the top 15 stores that were related to the best experiences overall. And this is interesting because you tend to think of children's stores as sort of smaller stores that a lot of people don't pay attention to, except if you have a kid. And even then, you're going to these stores for a finite period of your life. However, logically, merchandising these stores needs to be outstanding in order to push the experiential side of the business. Here recently on the Retail Focus, within the past 6 months or so, I believe we talked about the Disney store and their restructuring. This is a store base that is very profitable. However, they're actually looking to drive more sales because a lot of these stores are located in malls, and malls, as we know, have seen a little bit of a drop in traffic, especially in some larger metropolitan areas. And you see these stores really trying to promote the idea of an experience. They want kids to really see these big screen TVs at the front of their stores. They want them to be able to see the new pop culture merchandise really stand out. And this is a smart decision from that management's point of view. However, as it pertains to this study, the Lego store came in at number one as the best rated experience. So again, the store is in the same vein as Disney's and Carter's and these types of stores, but it's interesting because it is all driven by in-store displays. And most of the kids' stores are located, like I said, in malls, as we know, and they really have to catch the attention of those that are passing by. And so obviously, survey results looked at the past unique experiences and often rated the speed of service. Also, not only those in-store experiences, but the service, what kind of service they're getting from that in-store personnel, inventory management, cleanliness, and even parking. So these are things that we really don't even talk about much, and we'll talk about parking actually in our last story with Dave and Buster's, but we see that this is all very important for the customer experience. We want ease of use to happen everywhere around that retail center, not just within the store, but everywhere around that experience. That said, some retailers had an innate advantage in some areas from the start. Breaking down the different types of retail, it has quickly become obvious to us, at least, that apparel retail values general service and perceived value. And this is something we've talked about a lot. This is a theme that has gone all the way through apparel retailer over the past year or so. Companies like TJ Maxx have performed very well because of that perceived value. They're seeing that they have name brands in their shelves and also a very good value compared to the full priced outlets, something that these companies promote heavily. Not only TJ Maxx, but also Ross. And the winner in this particular category in apparel in terms of overall experience seems to be TJ Maxx. Again, according to the study, and this is a company that has been very successful in terms of year-over-year comps. And Trent, this is not the only company that experienced success as it pertains to this survey, but it's just so interesting because of all of these different facets that really pertain to the user experience in these stores, things that you and I just did not think about a whole lot.
And now joining us to talk about some of these results and the survey in more detail, we have Mark Lang, who's the CMO at Reputation.com, and Dr. Brad Knoll, who's the chief scientist at Reputation.com. Guys, thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Well, to start out with, obviously, a big survey with a lot of data going into it. We mentioned over 400,000 data points here. Can you explain a little bit about the significance of this report overall?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty clear. You know, everybody who's watching retail knows that improving the customer experience is an existential challenge right now, given the challenge that the web represents. And it's really the difference between thriving and dying for a lot of retail franchises. And so the significance of this report is the 400,000 data points that you mentioned are actually very granular sets, each of them, of data from the standpoint of online reviews and the free text the consumers are putting out in social media and on review sites and on Google and all over the web. And the significance really is, for the first time, it's possible now with technology to take that unstructured data and use it to get operating insights that you can use to improve the consumer experience at an individual location or nationally, right? And, you know, traditionally retailers rely on surveys. And surveys work, but they're very limited, right? And the insights you get are limited because you only learn what you ask. And there's bias, right? The only people who complete surveys typically are those who have time to do so. And the third sort of limitation with surveys is they are structured data. It's an easy problem to solve, but you don't get the kind of orthogonal, unexpected, full-throated feedback that somebody with a phone standing in line at a counter is likely to give you as a retailer. So the significance ultimately is about the unstructured data that retailers can mine, you know, for the first time, get really specific insights at the location level for what they can do to improve experience.
Now, going on from there, obviously you talked a little bit about it in the answer to the first question, but this is no easy task. Can you go about, without giving away any reputation.com secrets or proprietary technology or anything like that, can you explain a little bit about how you went about gathering this data and then also sequestering the data into these different categories that we've talked about?
Yeah, so the first thing we did, so we're about online reputation management. So the first thing we try to do is just go get all the information we can out there about these brands. So we look on review sites, we look on social, we look in search and maps, where you show up, what's ranking out there about you. And we pull all that information together into one place. That's the first thing we do. So for this analysis, we did that we hand selected these 28 brands across different segments of retail. We went out there, we pulled all the information we could find. And then once we had that in place, then our scientists, our data scientists went to work doing NLP, natural language processing, basically pulling apart the text of the reviews, what people are talking about, categorizing which aspects of the experience people are talking about, doing sentiment analysis to do that. Are they positive or negative about that aspect of experience? In line, looking also at kind of overall sentiment, particularly when you leave ratings and star reviews, and really trying to pull out, okay, what are people saying? What are people talking about when they're visiting these different stores? And how positive or negative, you know, are they when they're talking about these aspects of the experience?
So fascinating and lengthy process, of course. And you guys have been doing it in terms of data collection there at reputation.com for a very long time. So I want to step back and look a little bit beyond this year, just in general, in terms of the customer experience. Have you guys seen any trends one way or another outside of any individual retailer? Are customers valuing different things? Is their experience beginning to become maybe a little bit fragmented in one area over another?
Overwhelmingly, the biggest, you know, trend we're seeing over the last several years is just the sheer volume of data and the volume of feedback. There's really an exponential growth in how much data you can get and how much feedback you can get, and how precisely you can pull apart and really figure out at a deeper and deeper level what customers are talking about, what they care about, not just at a brand level, at a store level. If someone's talking about cleanliness or wait time, you know, how you can tie that to even, you know, particular salespeople, you know, the bathrooms versus the dressing rooms, all sorts of things. I think that's really, you know, the biggest trend is just how, you know, from our point of view, how much more data we can get and how deeper we can get into it.
Yeah, and in the last, you know, we got started in 2006 doing this, but in the last 4 years, what we've seen is, a major trend is that Facebook and Google are becoming totally dominant in terms of the capture of customer sentiment, right? You know, Google reviews and what people enter when they are searching on a map. There's a reason that Facebook and Google have the market capitalizations that they do, right? They're generating massive amounts of consumer-generated content in the form of, you know, commentary about how businesses are doing. And we've, as Brad said, seen this explosion in the volume of data and also increasing sophistication in the technology that you can use to make sense of it.
I know a lot of researchers sometimes try to remain agnostic about their data, and they're just like, here's the data, and we can extrapolate what we will from it. But looking at this survey, and again, because you guys have been doing this type of thing since 2006, there's always a few things that come up that surprise you. And with us, it was TJ Maxx being listed among the cleanliest retailers, since that's been a point of emphasis for their management, and they've struggled with that, but now getting better, obviously, and the sales are improving for it. As you step back and look at this year's data, was there anything in particular that surprised you about it?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few things that surprised us. I mean, TJ Maxx and Ross and Burlington, I think the analysis that we did here and the analysis we put out in the report focuses primarily on sentiment. But when we're looking at that sentiment, we're also looking at share of voice. How much are people talking about different aspects of the experience? And one thing that jumped out at us were these, you know, discount retailers, TJ Maxx, Ross, and those sorts of companies. It wasn't necessarily surprising that the thing people were talking about the most was price, but it's surprising, you know, how much more people are talking about it. Fully, you know, 30 to 40% of just the things people are saying when they go to visit those stores are about price and value, and how that's really driving the experience. And I think also in particular to TJ Maxx and cleanliness and some of that other stuff, it's also interesting to look at how people, the sentiment around things like cleanliness at a discount retailer versus a high-end retailer. And there's not that much of a difference. Consumers really seem to have, you know, certain expectations. The sentiment that they're leaving about your online brand is more a function of how satisfied they were relative to the expectations they had. So you can definitely see cases where consumers will be a lot more critical of a brand that you would have higher expectations for.
Yeah, so like as an example, you know, Ulta and Hugo Boss and some others were getting dinged on cleanliness, but their standards are probably the consumer standards. You get a, you know, sort of a psychographic insight here, because like the Lowe's and Home Depot customers weren't complaining about cleanliness at all, right? You know, if you're not tripping over loose pieces of lumber, you're probably pretty happy at a Lowe's or a Home Depot, whereas at a cosmetics counter, if you see, you know, a little bit of dust, you've got a problem.
So while we're speaking about expectation violations and that type of thing, or expectations being upheld, one of the things that you mentioned in the survey and in the study that came out later was the idea that in terms of interaction with managers, most brands scored pretty low there, because by the time someone interacts with a manager, chances are things have already gone wrong at some point in time, and that's already going to have a negative connotation associated with it. So it's kind of a different variable thrown into the mix that brings those scores across the board down. When you guys are performing this type of data analysis, are there other variables that pop up, not unlike someone being unhappy already by the time they go to talk to a manager, that might skew scores in general one direction or another?
Yeah, there's certainly those sorts of categories. And really the manager category, when we first started diving into retail data, I mean, not surprising after you see it, but certainly, you know, a little bit shocking just how negative people are. But there are several of those sorts of categories, manager, wait time, those sorts of categories where really the insight is might even be more in how much or how little people are talking about it. Really what you want to see looking at your reviews is that people aren't talking about these things.
That's another example of where the data surprises us, right, with the frequency of what customers are saying at any given store, right? You get indicators of relative happiness or lack of happiness on any of these nine dimensions, but you also get kind of a thermometer for passion, right? Where is the consumer most likely to be voicing their experience, positive or negative?
As we kind of close out this conversation here, I want to talk about some of the brands that finished pretty well that might not be doing so well in the sales column. And there's always going to be anomalies anywhere, anytime you've got a data set like this. But you're looking at a brand like Justice, let's say. Justice finished pretty favorably in your guys' ratings, yet Ascena Retail Group in general, but Justice in particular, certainly they've seen shrinking sales, they've had trouble with traffic and that type of thing. So now that this data is out there, now that this report is out there, what are some ways in which going forward the brands can kind of leverage this data to maybe turn things around and deliver to the customer a message that, hey, you know, we're actually doing pretty well for ourselves?
Well, they, you know, certainly like an athlete, right, you want to capitalize on your strengths and compensate or do something about your weaknesses. You know, Justice was pretty squarely middle of the pack in terms of the overall star rating. I think any retail business could learn a lot from the toy and baby stores, which did really extraordinarily well on a lot of dimensions. I would suggest that anyone concerned with retail operations and customer experience go to school on what the Lego store does, right? Their overall rating was 4.53. It followed closely by Disney at 4.49. And then you start to get into some specialty athletic wear, you know, Athleta by Gap, 4.39, Lululemon, 4.38. And then Nordstrom, right? And Nordstrom is legendary for customer service and customer experience, but even Nordstrom has a lot to learn from some of these stores. And I think, you know, to your point, we could theorize that the reason the toy and baby store category does so well is that the clientele are so demanding. Moms and little kids are not known for patience.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, just to add another thing to your point about if you have a good online reputation, how can you leverage that and how can you get that out there? We've also done a lot of analysis around, you know, how your online reputation dovetails with other kind of key drivers, other KPIs of the business, with ROI and things like that. And obviously, that's a lot of what we focus on, helping people, you know, kind of gather the most information, getting that information out there about you. And if you do have, especially when you already have a good online reputation, really, like, the best thing you can do is leverage that, seize on that, really, you know, reach out to your customer base, try to get more of that information out there about you online. The more you can get that tied to yourself, you know, to your homepage, to where you are online, that'll have massive impact in how you rank on search, you know, how much traffic can come to your website, how much more visibility and credibility you get for your brand. And we've certainly seen that in industries where we've done deeper analysis, that it does have a positive impact on sales as well.
And as we close it out here, again, I don't want any internal secrets or anything like that for reputation.com, but what's the next retail analysis that you guys are seeking, and what's the next thing that we might be able to expect from you guys?
So we'd like to expand this into other subcategories of retail and do it for a broader range of retailers. This was a select list, sort of representative of different categories of retail. The great thing about this kind of data is we can generate it for any major retailer for all of their locations. And so we can do these one-off, and we have a research program that will likely expand in terms of the number and the variety of categories. I think it's important, right? Because this is, you know, the only way that you can capture the unbridled voice of the customer that's most representative and authentic, right? These are people with phones who are impatient, unhappy, or delighted. And it's the only way you can get their, you know, sort of unbridled voice. And it's the only way you can put that kind of intelligence to work so that brick-and-mortar retailers can run better and keep growing. What's also interesting here is that the current state of so-called art in capturing customer sentiment on the part of retailers is in its Neanderthal stage. You know, you print out a receipt at point of sale and hand it to somebody and hope they're going to go to a website and fill out a survey. So the uptake rate, complete rates are obviously pretty low. And again, you get that kind of bias because who has the time to do that probably isn't your representative customer. When you start getting insights from that vast cloud of social data out there, what people are saying about you on the social web, it's spontaneous and it's fast, and there are absolutely no barriers in terms of the customer or the consumer's willingness to give you the feedback you need to run better. So we think the age of the store receipt survey request is coming to an end.
Yeah, and like I was mentioning earlier, we're already doing, you know, kind of deeper analysis with this same data. So this report focuses on the sentiment, but we're really diving into kind of that share of voice, much more of what people are talking about when they go to different types of stores. I mean, so it's not surprising, for instance, like I said, the people are talking more about price and value for a discount retailer, but how much more, how much that impact to you, and maybe how little people talk about that when they go visit a Sephora or a Lululemon, and how much they're talking about things like the experience and the experience there. And so the more we dive into that, what people are focusing on in different industries, we also, you know, want to do deeper analysis. Okay, so improving each of those aspects, how much can it improve overall customer sentiment about you? And then, like I was saying earlier, the more data we're getting, the deeper we can dive and then go even deeper in unfolding regional store-by-store impacts and really just unpeeling those layers of the onion and talking about what's driving at as granular a level as possible the reputation of some of these brands.
All right, fantastic stuff. Mark Lang, the CMO, and Brad Knoll, the chief scientist at Reputation.com. Thanks for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Delighted. Thank you.
Thank you, Trent.
Well, listeners of the Food Focus podcast know what that music means, and it's time for the Food Focus Inside the Retail Focus podcast. As each week from here until the foreseeable future, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about a food company or a food services company that released earnings or otherwise made the news. And we begin this particular segment this week with Dave & Buster's shares, as they went up over 8% in after-hours trading on Tuesday as the company continues to grow domestically. Now, Dave & Buster's is known for their restaurant and bar sales, but a large percentage of sales actually come from gaming, which is a good thing considering the amount of space their entertainment takes up in very high-rent areas, including a lot of shopping malls. Headquartered in Dallas, Texas, Dave & Buster's was founded in 1989. The company has actually been publicly traded two different times, once in 95, and then they were taken private until another IPO just a few years ago in October of 2014. Since their latest IPO, the company has been expanding sales through increased brand awareness and bigger market penetration. They've also acknowledged the importance to evolve over time. This includes limited-time offers and new games that are centered around pop culture events like comic-based films and Star Wars games, would be great examples of this, along with sports partnerships, particularly with Bellator MMA. They've also increased with national visibility. Now let's talk about the earnings, and Leighton will talk about the details in a second. Their earnings per share hit 27 cents per share, beating average estimates from analysts by 3 cents. Dave & Buster's brought in 25 cents per share last year. Net income provided a fairly robust 10.2% net margin for the company, which is excellent for a restaurant or entertainment operator. EBITDA margin was flat as a percentage of sales at 18.2%. The company brought in top-line sales that missed the mark, however, versus expectations, bringing in $250 million for the third quarter. This was a $5 million expectations miss. Still, the company also made double-digit gains year-over-year, with top-line revenue up 9.3% from 2016. It just wasn't up as much as analysts might have thought. Investors were arguably looking for a miss on earnings per share, as shares traded down Monday prior to the earnings announcement, over 2% just before the announcement and press release came out. As it was, earnings per share beat by 3 cents, and let's take a look as to why.
They did miss slightly, and it was a little bit of a depressing earnings call from that perspective. However, we mentioned their Texas base. Well, those hurricanes did end up taking a little bit of a bite out of sales, or potential sales at least. Comparable sales went into the negative territory as a result, negative 1.3% to be exact. People wanted to apparently play games more than eat food as well. So comparable store sales in their amusements category increased 1.1%, and food and beverage ended up decreasing a whopping 4.2%. So this is an area of opportunity, certainly, for Dave & Buster's. Hurricanes noted from management here, and they said that our team pulled through remarkably well in the face of unprecedented weather-related challenges in the quarter and difficult comparisons to last year. Wildfires in California were also to blame by management, and they were said to have an impact on those California markets, but the company did not say exactly how much traffic was affected, therefore top-line revenue was affected overall. We also mentioned in the company description how their business model is predicated on a larger square foot base in higher traffic areas. The company and its management is looking to utilize smaller footprint restaurants going forward, and this is something that actually did make headlines here. They're looking to have an entrance into smaller markets and therefore create a larger runway for longer term market opportunity. They're looking at having stores around 15,000 to 20,000 square feet in size versus the current format. Currently, according to their website, actually, and their website is extremely transparent in terms of what they're looking at in terms of modeling their real estate, between 26,500 square foot requirement and a 40,000 square foot requirement are both listed options on their website. So you can see this 15,000 to 20,000 square foot new smaller market version of Dave & Buster's is significantly smaller overall. And this is very interesting because if you look at the current requirements for these other locations that they have listed, the 26,500 square foot requirement and the 40,000 one, They said that they want to be in an area with a population of 700,000 to a million. This is the daytime population within 10 miles of a particular future location. Average guest travels 22 minutes to visit their stores, they said. And they said their target customer spans a diverse demographic, which seems to be the case. I recently visited a Dave & Buster's in the Kansas City area, and there's people of all types in there. And this was during lunch hour, a very busy lunch hour for Dave & Buster's, something that really struck me by surprise that adults were playing games around 1 p.m. in the afternoon on a Wednesday. They require a lot of parking space, which is something we had talked about earlier in terms of customer experience and how ease of parking really relates to the customer experience once they get inside the store. A happier customer tends to buy more. They want 10 spaces for every 1,000 feet of space. This is way more than the market average. However, they said they're open to sharing spaces with other competitors, not necessarily competitors, but adjacent stores, particularly in the mall setting. And you're looking at how this relates to their smaller market opportunity here with these smaller stores. All of this will have to be downsized. I am curious to see exactly what populations they're looking at, what kind of demographic they're looking at in terms of opening these smaller footprint stores. And you see, as for the United States, they said they have room in the U.S. for around 20 to 40 of these smaller locations long term, according to the press release. And they're really trying to take advantage of untapped demand. Again, not really saying or even alluding to where this demand is coming from. What geographical parts of the country is it taking place? And you see the increases overall in their runway for growth is going to be extended by about 10 or 20% from their previous 211 location total. Currently in North America, they have 105 locations. So if you tack on all of the additional locations, those full-size locations and these smaller locations, they have potentially another 140, 150 more locations to build out over the next few years. They cite strong operational results from new locations in 2016 and the ones that have been completed thus far in 2017. And this tells me one thing, Trent. This tells me that all of their real estate development teams have been very well in executing those new locations. They've done their due diligence and really scouting out these locations. This reminds me of Chipotle. Chipotle just doesn't pick a market and go in. They do years of due diligence in a particular market to make sure that once they enter, they won't leave, or at least they won't leave in the foreseeable future. And this is extremely important because these locations are much larger than a Chipotle. You have to have more staffing. You have to have more space to manage in terms of maintenance and those types of things that go along with that. They are on track to open 14 locations, 10 large format, 4 small format for fiscal 2017 in total. 8 of these 14 will actually be in new markets. So again, something very interesting, a new wrinkle in the game in Dave & Buster's.
Earnings per share for the company was helped by the fact that they bought back 2.1 million shares year to date, or at least up until the third quarter reporting period. They still have $147 million left in their share repurchasing plan. Shares for the year have been fluctuating between high 40s and low 70s, recently traded around $52 per share before the after hours earnings pop, which brought shares over $58.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead at stories that we're keeping an eye on for the next week or the next month, quickly reminding people. Also, if you've liked the show so far, make sure and rate us on Apple Podcasts, leave your Twitter handle, and you will be entered for a drawing to win an I Love Retail coffee mug. So regarding the stories we're looking ahead to, Leighton, we begin with you.
So my story has to actually have something to do with our food focus podcast, which we're kind of bringing into the fold here for the retail focus, but it has to do with a recent judge's decision on sort of providing a stay for Simon Malls. And Simon Malls is actually the owner and operator of over 80 malls inside the United States. And they've actually brought forth a lawsuit to Starbucks saying that those Teavana stores that they wanted to close, over 300 stores that they wanted to close, cannot be closed in Simon Mall locations because there's something within the contracts that say that as long as the lease agreement is in place, so however long that is, 10, 15, 20 years, the operator has to remain fully staffed and they have to operate for that whole duration. There's potentially no early leave clauses for Teavana in this circumstance. And the judge actually said that it could actually hurt malls overall. So the judge is actually taking a bigger view, not just for Simon Malls, but for the mall in general and other mall operators, other retailers that are within the mall space could be affected by these Teavana locations exiting early. And Starbucks said they are disappointed by the judge's ruling, but it looks as though they hope to find some sort of middle ground in the future. Again, they want to close these Teavana locations. They've already been able to leverage that brand within their Starbucks locations. I'm curious to see how this plays out. They've already started closing some other locations around the United States. It would be weird to see them just operating maybe 70 or 80 stores within the Simon Malls and to just have those Teavana stores in place while all of the other ones become non-existent.
My looking ahead story actually has to do with a little bit of looking back. It's at Duluth Trading Company, who just this week showcased a loss in their most recent quarter. It was a loss that took a lot of people by surprise, as they were expected by most analysts to be slightly positive on an earnings per share level. Now, granted, the loss was just of $800,000, so it's not a very large loss. Granted, they are a little bit of a smaller company. In fact, net sales of $83.7 million. Is a bit smaller than the retailers that we've talked about so far on the show. And while they did increase net sales year over year, the loss was somewhat unexpected and likely tied into attempting to build out their construct, but also tied into their marketing expense. Their marketing expense, something that Leighton and I have talked about as being necessary in order to continue growing Duluth Trading Company, especially as they open new locations. They opened 3 in the fiscal third quarter, and just in the last month, they've opened 3 new locations to now 31 brick and mortar stores. So while advertising is a necessity, we kind of wonder, looking ahead, if they will trim back those advertising costs because their margins are shrinking to such an extent. They cannot afford to show a loss in the fourth quarter, as already some sheen has been taken off of this growing company. They've grown net sales in 31 consecutive quarters. And although we think their sales will continue to grow, certainly, we kind of are concerned about the margins at Duluth Trading Company. And they've got to start to turn things around on the margin front if they want to return to retail darling status for 2018. They reaffirmed guidance and earnings per share, 66 cents to 71 cents per diluted share, and still expect a robust profit in the fourth quarter. And I'm looking ahead to whether or not that will happen, as well as their holiday sales, as they expect another 10 openings between now and the end of fiscal 2018. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Big thanks to the folks at Reputation.com, Mark Lang and Brad Knoll, for joining us on today's podcast. Be sure and tune in next week. Next week, we'll have a discussion about glitches and how glitches are costing e-commerce companies, in certain circumstances, millions of dollars. Looking forward to that again next week on the Retail Focus Podcast.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.